Greetings and welcome to VM Radio presented by Dowager Sciences. Today we have Dr. John Jaketa from Dowager Sciences, who is also the Vice President of the Weed Science Society of America, to tell us about herbicide product development and the EPA's Reduced Risk Pesticide Initiative. Thanks for joining us today, John.
It's my pleasure, Jim.
As we all know, it takes a lot of time, research, and financial investment to bring a herbicide to market. Can you give us an overview of what goes into that process?
It's a huge and highly complicated process, both inventing a new product and bringing a new product forward. And the average time it takes from discovery of a material like Milestone VM and its introduction into the marketplace, including an EPA registration, is about 9 years. There's a minimum of 120 different studies that are required, and these are studies that involve product chemistry and determining the physical and chemical characteristics of the molecule. Also studies that assess the potential toxicity of such a material on wildlife and aquatic organisms, mammalian toxicity, plant protection, reentry protection, will assess non-target insects. There's quite a few studies that are completed on environmental fate because it's very important that a product dissipate as expected and on time. There's also quite a few studies that are committed to residue chemistry so that the appropriate tolerances or maximum residue levels can be identified. And then, of course, there's work that goes into spray drift as well. All in all, that's probably somewhere around $150 million to $200 million worth of investment over that period.
And you mentioned environmental fate. In the current green movement that many industries face, there's a specific emphasis on environmental effects and environmental fate. Can you summarize the EPA's Reduced Risk Pesticide Initiative for us?
Oh, I certainly can. This is an initiative that EPA established about 1995. And what it does is it provides an expedited review for pesticides that may reasonably be expected to accomplish one of a number of goals that the agency has. There's about six goals. You don't have to it's a competitive assessment, so it's a assessment against the market standards. You don't have to be better than the market standards in every category, but you can't be worse than them in any. So the first one is reduced human health effects, and here we're talking about mammalian toxicity that's generally lower, and that is 10 to 100 times lower than the alternatives, and it should displace compounds that pose potential human health concerns, either through occupational exposure or through dietary concerns. It should be able to reduce exposure to mixers, loaders, applicators, and reentry workers. It should be able to reduce non-target avian effects. So it needs to have very low toxicity on birds, very low toxicity in honeybees, and be significantly less risk to both of those than the alternatives. It should broaden the adoption of integrated pest management strategies. And when EPA thinks about that, what they're really thinking about, and it's not a definition that everybody uses, but they're thinking about reduced pounds of a pesticide product on the ground. And so through the introduction of a low-rate material like Milestone VM, it actually displaces millions of pounds of other products because the products in that sector tend to be older. It should reduce non-target aquatic organism effects, have lower fish toxicity than the alternatives, or lower toxicity on aquatic invertebrates. And it should reduce the impact to groundwater and surface water as well. And if it can reduce the potential for pest resistance development, that's certainly something that'll work in its favor.
So I know you talked a little bit about the low use rate of Milestone VM. Can you expand on why Milestone VM has been reviewed and accepted under this initiative by the EPA?
Yes. It actually addressed all of the agency's criteria. It was reduced risk with compared to a number of commercial pesticides, commercial herbicides for non-target organisms, especially terrestrial vertebrates, birds and mammals, as well as aquatic and terrestrial non-target plants. It also reduced the net pesticide environmental burden, and because of its low use rate, it reduced the amount of material that could potentially move to ground or surface water through runoff. it was reduced risk compared to a number of other materials that it was directly compared to for human health. And this is both occupational and non-occupational exposures. And by that, I mean dietary exposures. So it did reduce the potential risk compared to several of the materials compared to. And it was found to be highly compatible with integrated pest management programs. And that was both in the reduction of pounds of total product applied to the ground, but it was also found to be highly efficacious where invasive weed control options were limited. This included tropical soda apple in Florida, but more. It was also much more selected to tree species than the competitive standards in rangeland and right-of-way IPM programs. It was also very effective for areas where resistance had developed to compounds like Diaron or the ALS-inhibiting herbicides, and this include herbicide-resistant horseweed or ragweed, prickly lettuce, several of the pigweed species, and it really did effectively reduce the serious environmental risk of the expanding national invasive species problem, and the agency did consider that.
And the issue of invasive and noxious plant species is really gaining attention among vegetation managers in terms of the environmental effects that they can have. Talk about the role of herbicides in general benefiting ecosystems by controlling these plant species.
Herbicides provide a huge benefit for the control of invasive plant species. They are by no means the only mechanism by which invasive plants can be controlled. There are other ways to do this, but if you have a perennial plant that has a deep and extensive root system and is capable of resprouting from those roots, then a herbicide is extremely useful. Across our nation, the most significant invasive weeds are spreading at approximately 15% a year, and this means that the infestation will double in less than 5 years. There's an old number of 4,600 acres lost per day on federal lands, and that number is a 2001 number. I'm sure the actual rate of gain here is even greater than that. There's a recent Cornell University report that estimates that the economic impact of invasive plants in the United States is about $34.7 billion annually, and when left uncontrolled, invasive species form a kind of biological pollution. That is, they produce many direct and secondary negative effects. You know, when weeds are left uncontrolled in a cornfield, what happens from that is you have a weedy cornfield. So there's economic loss, but having lamb's quarters and pigweeds growing in that field over the year, it doesn't really destroy the value of that land. When you have an invasive species take over the landscape in a national park or in a wildlands area, well, then tens of thousands of years of natural selection have now been blurred, and there'll be a single species there that has no competition, that has just completely consumed that area, and then we'll move forward along the edges. So knapweed species, for example, are an extremely good example of a very difficult invasive species that will not just expand rapidly, but also poison the ground below it with allelopathic compounds that allow nothing to grow but itself, a very effective competitor. Those impacts also reduce rangeland productivity, increase livestock production costs, increase soil erosion, threaten the reliability of utility power lines, and increase the need for railroad road maintenance, and increase fuel availability for wildfires. Really, invasive species, next to climate change, invasive species is probably one of the most grave issues that we face.
All right, great. Well, that's all the time we have today for this edition of VM Radio. Thanks again for joining us, John.
It's been my pleasure.
Stay tuned for more, and let us know if there's something that you'd like to hear about by visiting vmpodcast.com.